and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is March 20th, 2026, and this is episode 591. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in the western part of the Empire State, New York State. You are listening to Radio Warnerd. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd and subscribe to the show and support us, please. Anyway, I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Puglia, southern Italy. And John, how you doing?
Oh, okay. It's cold in Puglia. It's weird. It's been coldest year in a long time. Well, since we've been here, but that's not bad. The heat is worse.
Well, I think I've complained plenty about it already, but we've definitely had like Murmansk level weather here in Rochester this year. It's been a long, miserable winter. Anyway,
but that's when the fishers come out.
Yes. Yeah. Right. The fisher. I sent you a photo taken from a trail camera of a fisher. We get fisher cats have come back. Well, they're actually weasels or from the weasel family. Amazing creatures. Some of them get big, too. And speaking of Murmansk and Russia, I just had to drop this. Chuck Norris died today, 86 years old. Guy lived a long time. But the reason I bring him up is because I met Chuck Norris. I think it may be a couple times, but the first time, because he opened or he attached his name to the opening of a club in Moscow in sort of late 90s, and they advertised in The Exile. And so I think it was called Chuck Norris's Beverly Hills Club or something like that.
And I remember that.
Ben, you remember that? Yeah. So
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we went to meet Chuck. And, you know, Chuck really wants to meet you. It's supposed to be a big honor. So Tabby and I went to meet him. And, well, my first impression was, and I guess this happens a lot with macho movie stars, but he was really short with a large bearded head. And it was just kind of weird seeing him like that. And the second impression that I remember was just that he seemed to be talking to us off of a bad script. And I don't think he knows how to talk to people except by pulling lines from stuff he said. I don't know. It was as if I was meeting like an early Ronald Reagan or something, like, oh, yeah. You know, here we are, three Americans in Russia. Can you believe it? Or, you know, it was very stiffly spoken.
Well, Norris always has that feel, whether he's being interviewed or whether he's trying to do a line from the movie script. It's like he's looking in several directions and he seems really nervous about the whole deal.
Yes. But Bibi Netanyahu just posted, Sarah and I were deeply saddened to hear of the passing of Chuck Norris. So I don't know, maybe the Iranians did this to him or something. But, goodbye to you, Chuck Norris. Anyways, and one other quick thing I wanted to mention before we get to our guest, as you heard, Ben Aris. I just have to mention this even before Ben, if you don't mind, John, but there was an op-ed in the New York Times yesterday that had some tongues wagging. Most people didn't kind of, you know, go below the surface of it, except to kind of rage at it. It was titled that there's only one path to victory in Iran. And basically the thrust of the article was, stay the course, bomb them, we're on the verge of victory. The only way this thing turns bad is if we pull out. And the sort of the nut graph or the nut sentence on this is, and I'll just read this, if the United States can hold firm for the next few weeks, it can fully degrade Iran's war-making apparatus, which has already been fully degraded, as we've been assured several times over. Quote, this would usher in a multi-year interval of calm of the kind that neither sanctions nor diplomacy has been able to produce in over four decades. In that window, a better regional order could emerge. Now, the author of this piece is a former admiral, Mark Montgomery, who is a fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And if you know that, it is known as the most kind of uber hawkish, uber neocon think tank of all the think tank front groups. It began when it initially filed its documents with the IRS in the just before 9/11, actually. It was initially named the Hebrew word Emet for truth, and its mission statement to the IRS, and I'll quote, provide education to enhance Israel's image in North America and the public's understanding of issues affecting Israeli-Arab relations. It's basically a side project of AIPAC. And this gets better. Mark Montgomery was also one of the key figures in the Fat Leonard scandal, John, that you know of.
Wow.
He was cited by the higher command. He was reprimanded. Graft or whatever you call it. I know, because he wasn't jailed or anything, but he was indicted in a sense for graft and kickbacks. He basically got money and gifts from Fat Leonard and then kicked back contracts to him. So this is the guy then who was trying to push for sending in. He works the FDD, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, is funded by all the weapons manufacturers and Israeli, pro-Israeli billionaires. And he wants to send Americans in to die. And I mean, this is the guy. But it's the key, I think, here is that it's the New York Times publishing it, you know.
Yeah.
That's the real atrocity here. And
yeah, well, there's been a lot of turbulence, internal dissent, if you like, in the Times, but there's no sign of any change at the top. There's a group that's just locked in, and they seem to go to the same parties, and that's that. And they decided long ago.
They love their empire, and they'll do anything to save it.
Yeah.
So on that note, let's bring back friend of the show, returning guest, Ben Aras. He's the founding editor of BNE and Telenews. A great media site that has correspondence and articles from, well, initially it was from sort of the former, you know, Soviet sphere in the post-Soviet era, but has expanded globally. Ben has talked with us on previous occasions about the economic warfare side of the Ukraine war and has been really a great source for us. So, Ben, thanks for coming back on Radio Warnerd.
My pleasure to be here, always.
Yeah, it's always under the worst of circumstances, isn't it? But yes. Thanks for coming on. So today we're going to talk about the economic side of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. And really the economic side of this war, well, in a sense, there's kind of a similarity with Ukraine because the U.S. opponent in both wars, their biggest weapon, in a sense, is the vulnerability of Team USA's side economically. Economically, how vulnerable they are. Although in this case, this seems to be magnitudes larger in terms of the damage and potential damage to the global economy and to the United States and its friends and allies. Where do you want to start, Ben?
You've linked already the former Soviet Union and the Iran war. I mean, what jumps out at me is, I mean, as you say, there are lots of similarities. And Trump seems to be making all of the mistakes that Putin made in invading Ukraine. I mean, first thing is that he seems convinced that the Iranians were going to capitulate after days. And Putin made that mistake. And then what he faced was, a heroic resistance, but mismatched. And the same's going on here, that the States has gone in with its arrogant assumption that it has the most powerful military in the world, but that makes it invincible. And the big difference between Ukraine and Iran is that Iran has oil. And moreover, it has this stranglehold, this choke point in the Straits of Hormuz. And with that, it has an asymmetric option to stop the energy flows and to disrupt a fifth of the world's supplies. And that's somewhere also that Trump can't go because, you know, we're talking about $200 oil if they decide to, you know, smash the whole region. the Qatar, I mean, the Israelis hit the South Pars gas field day before yesterday. And the Qataris just came out, Qatar Energy, the company that runs that, came out and said, all right, we've lost 17% of our export capacity. And some of
that's because the Iranians hit the Ras Laffan LNG complex in Qatar.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the retaliation.
Yes.
And this is already, we're slipping into a nightmare scenario because we've gone from the mere disruption of hydrocarbon flows, which is what has been the last 2 weeks, where in theory, if there's a peace deal or a capitulation, then you can go back to normal very quickly. But if you destroy the production, that's a whole different kettle of fish. And Qatar by itself accounts for a fifth of the world's LNG, and the prices now have doubled, but they won't go back down again because that production is gone. And with that retaliation, I mean, they only took out two of 14 of the LNG trains. So it's also a warning. It's like we could take out the rest. And we're escalating step by step. But, you know, we're only in week three and we've already got to the point where we've gone from disruption to destruction. And that's Iran's trump card. And I think
Ben, real quickly, can I go there? Yeah, but can I just ask you real quickly about the LNG? Because my understanding is that, for example, if you hit a refinery and the Iranians have hit several refineries, which we'll, I'm sure, also talk about, including Kuwait's largest refinery. They just hit it for a second time. But from looking at what's happened in the Ukraine-Russia war and how Ukraine has really caused damage to various Russian refineries, but the Russians have been able to get them back online or account for it, you know, soon enough anyway. But as opposed to that, with these LNG complexes, when you hit those, they don't go back on. You can't repair them as easily. They're very flammable. And from what I read, you said 17% of their capacity is already taken out. That means it's taken out 17% of one of the world's, of maybe the world's largest provider of LNG. And it takes 3 to 5 years to rebuild it. And Qatar's already slated to lose, I think I read something like $20 billion annually just so far.
Yeah.
Is that right? So that's the LNG complexes are a lot more, natural gas is even more vulnerable than the oil refineries.
Well, there's another big difference between Ukraine and Iran. That the Ukrainians have launched the last summer this campaign to hit Russian refineries and to basically take out or reduce Russia's ability to make money. The difference is that Ukraine has developed these long-distance drones, but those things only carry about 50 up to a maximum of 100 kilograms of explosive. Moreover, as a function of the Cold War, all of Russia's refineries were hard-topped when they were built. They were made resistant to attack. And the key here is that Ukraine doesn't have missiles. It doesn't have any powerful missiles. It's got this, what is it called, Firebirds the Flamingo. But they fired one of them so far. I mean, I don't believe. I think it's all been propaganda. You know, psychological weapon.
Peter Kotatayev wrote about how a lot of that is just a graft operation, you know, a corruption operation.
I mean, they spent they've got a $1 billion budget and they fired one missile that I've seen confirmed reports.
Yeah, so basically the Ukrainians don't have the missiles to hit refineries and really do damage. And their drones just don't have the capacity, the payload.
The Ukrainian drones on refineries are basically, you know, mosquito bites. And so you can fix the refinery pretty quickly. But if Iran were determined to destroy an LNG facility like South Pars, they can do it. They can flatten it. And moreover, the technology, I mean, it's been reported that Iran now has fired its first hypersonic missile. This is a Russian technology. The Chinese have it as well. The Americans do not have that. And moreover, these missiles are so sophisticated that they can dodge the Patriot interceptors. And this wasn't expected.
Right. And I mean, basically what we're talking about here is the absolute vulnerability of the Gulf states and the Gulf industries and economies.
The consequences of blowing up, you know, Qatar's entire LNG production for the global economy are just catastrophic.
Yeah.
You're going to get, you know, prices going through the roof, which will cause a global recession, which will cause several countries, weak countries like Egypt and Pakistan, to have at least go into recession, if not go into like financial crises. And we're looking at, I mean, put it this way, the short answer is that we've got a vintage crisis on our hands, as good as 1998, as good as 2008, as good as 2022, energy crisis. You know, this is going to be a classic.
Yeah, the International Energy Agency just said this is the worst energy crisis in its history.
And it hasn't started.
And it's barely started. This is the thing, yeah. I think that people don't quite get, that Iran has, and they've been saying this, I've seen their foreign minister, you know, posting this on Twitter. They keep saying, we're only just barely beginning to play our cards in this. Yeah. We will go, you know, all the way, and everybody will pay badly. We will too, but everybody will. We haven't played any, you know, we're just giving you a demonstration so far, and it's not getting through to people's heads, and including in financial markets. I mean, I don't know what you think, Ben, but it kind of surprises me. I know that crude has gone up a lot, but I don't think crude has quite priced in. Think that the Americans and Israelis, they still have a lot of faith that they're going to solve this, is what it looks like.
That's a very interesting point. I mean, we're both veterans of multiple crises, and it's very dramatic. We're seeing like missiles rain down on Tel Aviv and in Qatar and Saudi Arabia, etc. But the way crises work is you have the initial shock, and we had oil trading at $65 pre-war, and now it's already at 100. But that sets off a chain reaction. I like to describe it as the crisis virus, because what happens is it spreads down the supply chain. And that's actually a slow process. Mm. So if you take the 98 Russia default on its debt, that happened on August 17th. But the market, the stock market, didn't reach its nadir until October. Mm. It takes about 2 months. So the example I've been bringing up recently is that, you know, not only does the Straits Hormuz carry most of the oil out, but it also carries food in, because nobody in the Gulf produces anything. Right. And the supermarkets are reporting, we're about to run out of fresh fruit and salad. And I think it's today or yesterday that supply is dried up.
Where, in the UAE or?
In the UAE, in Dubai, the supermarkets. Uh-huh. And then, because it takes 2 months, you have some stockpile, you have to burn through it, and then it's, you know, here we are 3 weeks later, and suddenly they run out of fruit and veg. But the prices of fertilizers, that, you know, the Straits is responsible for 25% of oil and gas exports, but it's responsible for a third, 30%, 33% of fertilizer exports. So those now have also doubled in price, and none of that's getting out. A bit of oil's getting out, but none of the fertilizer's getting out. In March is when farmers buy fertilizer to put in the fields. So already we've got a crisis in fertilizers, but because the farmers now can't afford the fertilizers, they're not going to fertilize their fields, which is going to have a knock-on effect to food production. And that crisis won't hit until August or September, when the yields on the crops are halved. So we're waiting for a food price shock that won't arrive until the end of the summer. And as I say, it spreads out. And the damage that's already been done, even if it were to stop tomorrow, is still spreading. And so actually the worst is ahead. And probably we won't reap peak pain until August or September.
Right. Let's talk about some of the other commodities here, because we know about, you know, oil and gas more. But there are a lot of other products, you know, as you mentioned, fertilizers, you know, urea, helium. So yeah, let's talk about helium. So helium is important. Well, can you describe why even helium would be something that Qatar is such a big player in, and what it's used for?
It's a byproduct in the production of LNG.
Okay.
You know, you're dealing with methane and gases, and you produce helium. So, again, Qatar is a massive producer of helium. Helium is a very difficult thing to work with, because the helium atoms, molecules, are so small that it's very hard to contain them. They're basically so tiny. What they do is they eat into metal, they escape, and so your helium boils off. Moreover, helium, you can't liquefy it, because it freezes at only 4 degrees above absolute zero. So there's
it's
no
number
way.
Number two expect... on the chemistry.
I think it's
chart.
Number one.
No,
oh, yeah, it's number
one
two
is
on
hydrogen.
The chemistry chart.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's number two on your Mendeleev. Good for you. Yeah, there are some periodic table.
Yeah.
So it's number two, but it's number one in terms of liquefying helium.
Right.
Hydrogen is slightly higher, but you know, to get something down to 273 degrees below zero is just in energy, you can't do it.
Right.
So you can't store it. It's incredibly difficult to store, which means that people have stockpiles of it, but they only last for 45 days until they basically boil away. So again, people do have some stockpiles. And why is all of this important? Because helium is absolutely crucial to making microchips. Mm-hmm. You have to use supercooled helium in order to freeze the chips down to the point where you can etch them. And you cannot make microchips, semiconductors, without helium. And everyone's going to run out of their stocks in 45 days. Now, there are other places where it's made. You can
Russia,
get it.
Right.
Yes.
Is
Russia,
it sanctioned? Is it sanctioned? The Russian helium
no.
also? Okay.
No, of course not.
Yes,
you know, all
okay.
the things that you yeah. can't get anywhere else, like helium, like LNG in Russia, uh-huh. none of that's sanctioned because there's
right.
no other alternatives and there's not enough. But then that's going to have a knock-on effect because, what's it called, TSMC in Taiwan, which is
right.
You know, the world leader, is basically going to have to shut down production again in a couple of months' time. And there's already a chronic historic shortage of semiconductor chips because of the AI boom.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly the price is going to go through the roof. And what the company will do is take what limited supplies it has and it will stop doing the mass production. But then that means you can't make iPhones, you can't make computers, or at least, you know, everything's massively reduced. You have to go back two generations.
Wow.
And this is, again, all in the Middle East. I mean, the thing is, you know, gas is basic to all sorts of, you know, plastics. Already the Asian plastics mm-hmm. producers, petrochemical related, they're
because
already
of the
going
NAFTA?
Into crisis. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and you know, naphtha is missing, helium is going to be missing, and sector after sector is going to be infected by this crisis virus, which is now creeping down the supply chains. Dubai is rather, supermarkets has just run out of fruit and veg.
Yeah,
fertilizers will be next, then there will be a food shock after that, then the plastic producers will stop, then you know, so on and so on. I mean, it's going to affect everything, which is why I'm saying this is such a vintage crisis.
Yes.
And already the damage is massive, but we're not feeling it. But you mm-hmm. will do when you get your electricity bill in a few months' time, when you mm-hmm. get your food bill in a few months' time, because all that stuff's going up.
Another one is aluminum. Both Bahrain and was it Qatar are major aluminum producers or smelters.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, has been cut off as well. So, again, that will also help Russia, which is one of the world's, if not the world's largest aluminum producer, if I'm
mm-hmm.
not mistaken. So, you know, this is, I mean, I think this is why when we talked about it earlier, it's kind of hard to talk about this war without talking about the Russia-Ukraine war. It all does, I mean, we see, you know, we see kind of the more surface stuff, which is drones and Zelensky offering Ukrainian know-how. In fact, there was just an article in Murdoch's The Times, the British one, that these Ukrainian drone experts who are, you know, experts in combating against Iranian-derived drones. Now, the Russian Gedan drones are already, I think, somewhat different than the Shahids, but they also, the Russians, I'm sure, shared their know-how with the Iranians, which is why the Iranian
Russia.
Drones are doing so well. So the
yeah.
so the Ukrainians have offered their services to the Gulf states, and at least what's being reported is that the Ukrainians have been shocked at how the Gulf states and the U.S. have been blowing through interceptors just to shoot down. Like
yeah.
they said, 8 Patriot interceptors for each target. They like firing and so they've already blown through they said in the first 4 days, the Gulf and the U.S., they blew through 800 Patriot interceptors. Now, the the Ukrainians in 4 years of war have only gotten 1,000 in total.
Yeah.
And they just blew through that. And there aren't a whole lot of these interceptors around.
So this is another aspect of the asymmetrical war that the White House hasn't taken account of, is that it's to do with what we've been calling the cost to kill ratio, and that it costs $4 million to make a PAC-3 Patriot interceptor, and they only produce about 600 a year. And in the first 3 days, there was a very nice study recently that she went into the details. So of the 34 munitions that the Americans have been using, 14 after 3 days were already at critically low production levels. Trump called in the CEOs of all the major arms firms like last week and screamed at them and said, like, you guys need to do overtime and produce more of this stuff because we're running out already in the first weeks before the first month is up. And they were like explaining to him, like, yeah, we can go from 600 to 1,000, and that will happen next year.
Yeah. I mean, they really thought this thing through, didn't they?
They didn't. it's shocking.
Yeah.
The thing that stuns me about this is, like, Zelensky offered Trump last year a $50 billion swap, saying that we will sell you $50 billion and swap, you know, your Patriots for our drone technology, which is state of the art. And Trump told him to, you know, to get lost. Zelensky called him again last week and said, like, now you need the drone technology. And again, he turned it down because, again, I think he's still fixated, like, we don't need, and he said explicitly, we don't need your help.
Yeah.
But yet the thing with the Ukrainian drone production is, as I said, they're producing about 4 million a year. And recently, last 6 months, they've specifically developed these interceptor drones, which can not only bring down not just drones, but missiles, but they can also bring down jet fighters. They can bring down helicopters. They've got one with a rotating turret and a machine gun that chases helicopters. And the Russians have, like, they can't fly anything now anywhere near Ukraine because of this stuff. But the poignant point here is that the Ukrainians are saying that we're operating at a quarter of our industrial capacity. We need investment. If we had that investment, we could triple our output of drones of all sorts, including these interceptors. And nobody's given them any money. Nobody's investing. I don't understand why the White House isn't, like, or at least the European Union, isn't flying to Kiev and dropping several billion dollars.
Because for Trump, it would be seen as a humiliation. Having to get help from Ukraine, and as an unacceptable humiliation. And for Trump, everything, including this war, is about the appearance of domination, of manly anti-woke domination.
It's the answer. Look, the answer's there in your lap. It's like, drop $1 billion on Kiev. And they already have the factory set up. And it's not like we're going to produce the interceptors next year. They could have them by the end of the month.
But aren't a lot of the drones that I mean, look, the Ukraine-Russia battlefield, I mean, in that way, we're talking about two vastly different wars. These are, you know, large, conventional, old,
infantry-based
with shit tons of drones, thousands and thousands and thousands of drones, you know, crowding the skies at all times. It's almost unimaginable. Someday, I guess, they'll be able to depict in movies or documentaries or something how this actually looks. And so, whereas, you know, I mean, the Ukrainians have not, they have, of course, a lot of experience and know-how on how to down the Gedon drones, which are you know, originally based off the Shaheds. But, you know, the Russians also have got a lot of their drones through. But I guess my point is a lot of the Ukrainian drone technology is really about how drones are used on the front to terrorize infantry and logistics. Isn't that right?
Look, there's a nice example. So a couple of weeks ago, there was a NATO exercise in Estonia, and they were, like, basically practicing to fight the Russians. And they invited a single unit of Ukrainian drone operators, 10 guys, who came with their kids. And then the exercises started, and by lunchtime, these 10 guys had destroyed an entire battalion of NATO forces with their drones, an entire battalion. And the NATO generals were looking on, and they were in shock. I mean, the quote from one of the generals was, I forget who reported it, New York Times, I think it was, like, we're fucked. We are totally unprepared to deal with this. And everybody's ignored it. And again, you've got von der Leyen and her EU rearm program, 800 billion. They've already spent 150. And they're doing the same thing. They're buying Patriots and F-35s or F-16s, and they're fighting the wrong war. And Zelensky's sitting there with the solutions. And the irony here is that because of this crink alliance of Iran, Russia, China, that Iran is fighting the same modern war that Zelensky's fighting with spectacular effects. He's held off Russia. He's only captured 20% of the territory, and Russian troops cannot move. They bomb them with their superior jets and their glide bombs, which are heavy ordnance that the Ukrainians don't have and don't have a defense against. And yet you cannot follow up with infantry. You can't move, because anybody who steps into that no man's land is dead. There's, the kill rate on drones is like 50-60%. If you shoot at someone with a bullet, it's like fraction of a percent. But what are the Americans doing? They're going into Iran with exactly the old school mentality. We're not going to lose anyone. We're going to sit on our ships and fire Tomahawks. But you only make 800 of those a year.
Yeah.
And they've burned through. As I say, of the 34 munitions, 14 of those are already down at critical level. So that it's the States that's going to have to capitulate by the end of next month, because they've run out of ammo.
Yes. Speaking of some of these numbers, I just saw somebody post, somebody, I think it was an academic guy or writer. Anyway, he posted the per capita spending on military spending of each of these countries. So Iran per capita spends $90 per Iranian citizen on its military. The U.S. spends $2,900 per citizen. So that's, a few hundred times more on $2,900 per citizen on its military. And Israel spends $5,000 per citizen. Of course, some of that is subsidized by the U.S. So the point, I think, is that Iran... it seems like the one of the goals here of the U.S. is to so overwhelm and basically impoverish the Iranians, I don't know, by supposedly taking Karg Island. They're so fixated now on a silver bullet, Karg Island being the silver bullet, that Iran won't have a capacity to fight anymore within weeks. But Iran already is a low, low cost military, and it doesn't need to have a conventional force, which again is so different from the Ukraine.
Again, the States is thinking in its own terms, and that we spend a lot of money, then we can gear up and crush them. And you're exactly right.
Well, I mean, the U.S. Navy has been speaking really for decades about the moment when its mythical laser weapon will be ready, because that will overcome the inequality of attackers to defenders, which is really impossible. You can't store enough interceptors on a typical Navy ship to kill everything that might be sent against it. But you could do that in theory with the lasers.
There was a report, I saw a report about microwave weapon that's just been tested. But all these things seem to be, I'm not a military
expert.
Ben,
John can tell you as a fan, as a young nerd fan of war, Jane's and Aviation Weekly. John, that laser weapon has been right around the corner, I swear to God, for 5 decades.
Oh, yeah, it's like evangelical
decades.
Jesus, the coming of Christ.
Yes.
The second coming.
Yes.
Yeah, but it needs now. They need now. It has to happen now. And they're not there. As I say, I've seen reports, but it's like the Wunderwaffe that Hitler was always talking about to turn the tide. But the joke is that the Iranian technology is there, and moreover, the factories are there, ready to go. And you could turn this around very fast. But as you say, I don't know, a combination of ignorance, arrogance, is that they're not going to go to Ukraine. But for me, my takeaway from this war is that I'm just stunned that there's a new modern way of doing it. We've been following it closely in Ukraine, who have taught everybody a lesson. And there's an arms race going on between Russia and Ukraine on drone tech that's driven it at incredible speed to incredible levels of sophistication, really fast, and it's all ready. And you've got the problem that Russia is connected to Iran. And so last year they did a technology deal transfer where the Iranians sold the rights and tech expertise for developing drones, the Shaheds. And so Russia set up a huge factory to produce these things. And as you've mentioned, Mark, I mean, they've gone from the Gerard 2 up to the Gerard 5. And these things are very sophisticated. So Europe is also screwed because it's got no defense against drones.
Yeah, neither do the Americans in the Gulf, for that matter, as we've seen with all the hits.
Yeah, and carriers are and the V-22 carrier, whatever it is when it tries to storm through the choke point, they're very fragile. They're innately fragile because too many different technologies are going on the many decks. And there's this sense that I've seen articles recently like, you know, it's very hard to sink a carrier. Well, that's kind of disingenuous at best because you don't have to sink them. I mean, you have to.
All you need is a fire in the laundry room and it's done. You know? Like, what the hell? Yeah. Literally, there's even talk that that fire may have been set deliberately by sailors who didn't want to become sitting ducks for Iranian drones. Yeah. And maybe that's a way of spinning what is just actually an incredibly vulnerable ship that catches fire and has toilets exploding despite the $13 billion price tag. But yeah, it's...
While we're on this subject, I mean, as I say, I think Trump's doubling down and he still hasn't got it about the asymmetric nature of the war and that they're sailing now. The rest of the U.S. Navy forces are on the way to the Gulf. They'll arrive by the end of this month, including troop carriers with on the Tripoli. Marines. There's like 5,000 guys. And I saw a report today that they've just taken another 4,000 guys
from San Diego.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
And that's insane because if they land them and try and capture the coast, I mean, the tight bit in Hormuz is only like 30 kilometers long. And there's a couple of islands which you can occupy and, in theory, defend. But again, they don't understand the nature of the war. These guys, the Marines, if they think it's going to be some sort of Private Ryan storming of Normandy beaches, and then they'll control it, and then they'll be able to allow, you know, stop the drones attacking, it's not going to work. They're going to be sitting ducks because they'll get swarmed by drones in the same way that the Russians sitting in no man's land on the front line in Donbass are just annihilated. They're just slaughtered. And there's no protection. And as we've said, that the States and Europe, too, has no effective counter-drone measures. In other words, their own drones. They haven't invested in this. They don't have the production. They don't have the numbers. And the Iranians have that in spades. So I don't know. It's going to be a bloodbath if Trump goes there.
To some degree, this is a really venal decision. And it has been in every budget for decades, because I remember an interview in Armed Forces Journal about 20 years ago with a high-ranking naval officer who said, nobody ever made joint chiefs by being head of drones. Right. And that's true. It also won't get you a big golden retirement once you go back into private industry the way piloted weapons will do. That in a way, it's their attractive features that made them unattractive to a really venal Navy.
Mm. Yeah, and all forces. So I think you're right, though. It looks like what I read was the first expeditionary or amphibious force that's heading towards the Gulf has already past Singapore, so, but you know, if you believe what, there's a lot of flack out there, and could be in the general area by the 25th. I don't know how long it'll take for the second force to arrive, but it is as stupid and crazy as it seems, what can we learn as observers? If it's stupid and crazy, it'll probably happen, you know? And that's so far like the lesson of the American side of this war. The thing about these wars is that it never goes the way you expect them to. And mm-hmm. this one is so much more, you can easily imagine how much unimaginably worse this thing can get. If the Iranians see that the U.S. is actually preparing to try to take land or move the Marines into the Arab Sea, Arabian Sea, or the Gulf, and things move to that level, they will decimate the rest of LNG, oil, and other industrial infrastructure in the Gulf. They will bring the whole world economy crashing down, and they can.
Because they don't care.
Why would they? This is an existential war for them. What else do you do? They've already warned over and over, this is what we will do. They warned beforehand, if you actually attack, this is what we'll do. They keep telling us. And Trump doesn't want to listen because Trump cannot accept that somebody has escalation dominance over him. It's like a better dead than red thing for Trump. It's better that everyone dies than he gets humiliated. And he cannot accept the reality of that situation. And it's just...
Do you not get... We don't have correspondence in Washington. I hear bits and pieces every now and again from what context we do have, but... I get a very strong sense here that the White House is starting to panic, that they're starting to wake up to the realities of how badly this is going, mainly through the lack of ammo issue. But Trump, that once he starts to face up to reality, the generals tell him that, that everyone's going to die if we land them. The arms producer saying, we're going to run out of missiles in April, and that's the end of it. There's nothing to be done about that. That isn't he going to chicken out and do some sort of deal?
I wouldn't count on that myself.
I would be afraid in Trump's case that he must, in some corner of his mind, realize I've got a couple of years at best going to take everything with me.
Yeah, and on top of that, I don't think the people, this is also what I've been reading, and it looks validated by what we're seeing. He's surrounded by, and this happened with Biden, and it happens a lot, he's surrounded by only a couple of people who are absolute sycophants, constantly tell him what a genius he is, tell him how well this war is going. Basically, their excuse for why it's not necessarily going exactly our way is because the Iranians are cheating.
And the TV is unpatriotic.
Yes, the TV is unpatriotic, so we may have to pull some licenses. But I don't think Trump believes. I don't get this sense from him at all, or Hegseth, that they think this war is doomed in any way whatsoever.
Well, he's had a lifetime of business books that are ghostwritten, telling people that will is everything, and that will can remake the world. And the funny thing is, it can't.
Yeah.
You can will all the military technology to overcome the Gulf of Hormuz, but it's still going to sit there. I mean, in a way, the really strange thing is that Newt Gingrich's insane, childish plan to explode 5 H-bombs along the route of the Gulf of Hormuz to straighten out the path and make a new straight, that makes more sense than will alone will do it.
Yeah. You know, what's funny about that is Gingrich took that from a satirical post and he thought it was serious and then claimed it as his own. So it's even better. And that was the intellectual of the Republicans, by the way. But yeah.
I mean, but one of the reasons I asked my question is that, we follow Russia closely and the Dmitriev camp, and which leads us to Vitkov and also to the Amanis, who've been leading in the mediation in this, who are pushing very hard to try and find a way out. And that Vitkov, as far as we know, has actually made two approaches to Tehran via Oman. to ask if there's any chance of starting talks. And he, as I say, I mean, why would he ask for this when Trump is convinced that Iran is about to collapse?
Right.
So okay, I don't know if it's a twin trick. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they do think. I think they think they need to start dialogue.
But it's okay. That's true. But I think also for Trump, it's a way of testing out to see how badly the Iranians are doing and are they ready to call to say uncle yet, and. It's one of the reasons why the Iranians, I think, aren't talking. I mean, on top of the fact that Trump has backstabbed them every time they've tried talking to him.
Yeah.
But there's also, talking is itself a signal of your strength or weakness, especially to Trump.
Another horrific mistake that Trump's made with the decapitation, which, as I say, if you decapitate a regime with a dictator, then it collapses because the guy's in charge. And what's happened in Iran is that the Ayatollah was bad. But by killing him, what you've replaced him with, his son, is even more extreme, even more fanatical. Moreover, he's a IRGC placeman.
And also, we killed Larijani, the top security chief, who was also more of, I mean, it comes out later, like John Simpson, even from BBC. Everyone really kind of liked this guy. He was very smart.
You could do business with him.
You could do business with him. And he's replaced by Hossein Dehghan, I'm maybe pronouncing it wrong, who is much more, as they would say, hard line. This is a guy, they replaced him with a guy who took part in taking, you know, the American embassy hostage, taking the hostages in 1979. And he's accused of being the top Iranian IRGC point man for the 1983 bombings in Beirut that killed 241 American Marines, which is the largest single day, you know, death toll of Marines since Iwo Jima. That's who we replaced him. So it's not decapitation if the head that grows back is more dangerous, more hostile, more determined. It's the opposite. It's just the stupidity, the levels of stupidity here are just mind-boggling.
But it's a strategy. You know, again, the West is going in, like, you know, be reasonable in Ukraine. They've been badgering Zelensky into basically giving up the Donbass, which Putin has been adamant about. And if he does give up the Donbass, then deal's done and the war in Ukraine will stop. But the people you're dealing with now in Tehran, the people you were dealing with in Tehran, I mean, even Trump admitted there were several people there we thought we could talk to and do business with, but we killed them all.
Yeah.
And what you're left with.
It was like a Scorsese mafia
very
guy
doing
a comedy bit. We killed them all.
What you're left with are radical fanatics. And I come back again to my point, in an asymmetric war, only one needs to get through. And so with these people in charge, they don't give a shit about anything. They don't give a shit about the global economy or energy markets or anything. That they're out to punish.
They're out to punish and they're out to have Iran survive. And their way of thinking, they're the people.
I don't think they care. I don't think they care if Iran survives. I think they want the regime to continue. But put it this way, the amount of pain and damage they're prepared to suffer. I had a friend who used to go to Millwall football matches. Millwall, famously, football matches, extremely violent. Everybody used to throw 50p's at each other, you know, in the sort of hectagonal kung fu weapon that we have it for money. And he got into a fight with three guys, and they came up and said, like, and he's like, yeah, come on, if you want to go, have a go. And they were like, but there's three of us. And he said, yeah, there's three of you, but I don't care if you hurt me. You'll care when I hurt you. And he fought them, and they lost because he's prepared. He doesn't care what they do to him. He's going to inflict more pain. And Iran is like a Millwall supporter. They will go in, and they don't care what you do to them. They will bloody your nose. And the options with the weapons that they have is to cause the most horrific economic crisis we've seen since God knows when, since the 20s.
I suppose the answer to this would be what? Like, to determine the date on which they mine the straits? I mean, because that's
straits
something
are already
that,
mined.
There's already some mining, but not fully mined, as far as we know. There is also kind of like how they've done some damage.
What they've done with the mines, as far as we know, is the southern. So the channel, there's two lanes that go through the middle of the channel.
Right.
in and out. And what they've done is they've mined the southern part,
right,
which is for, so the route now is that the ships that are kind of transitioning, the Iranian ships, Chinese, Bangladeshi, Indian, are being forced to sail very close to the shore. So that anyone...
They've narrowed the strait, basically. Yeah.
Well, they moved the traffic
yeah.
close to the shore, so everything's in range of the most right. pathetic drones that they have. And this is another massive change, because I think that as part of that day before the war started negotiation in Geneva, that Vitkov was demanding that the Iranians dismantle its navy. And I think part of the plan here, although this hasn't been said out loud, was that the Americans were hoping to take control militarily of the passage through the straits. And part of that is part of a game plan, which again hasn't been said out loud, but seems to be emerging, that Trump is trying to control the oil supplies to China. Because I think he's fixated on China as our main strategic rival. And they have a monopoly over our rare earths and critical minerals. And so what I'm going to do is take control of their oil supplies, which is what Venezuela, bulk of its oil went to China.
Right.
Bulk of the oil coming out of the Gulf goes to China. And so I think the idea was to put the U.S. military or the Navy into the straits. But the irony of this is that currently that a channel that was open to international traffic under the maritime right of innocent passage, anybody can sail through there who wants to, is now strictly under the control of the Iranians, who are only allowing friendly countries to go through. Specifically, their own tankers are leaving. They're all going to Asia. The Chinese have been given a pass, all going to China. The Indians have been given a pass. The Pakistanis and the Bangladeshis have all been given a pass. All the oil now is going to Asia, which is Iran's friends. And you've taken it off the market for Americans and the Europeans in particular. And for Europe, I don't know if we want to get into this, but Europe is in the most horrific position imaginable. It was already suffering a gas crisis. The tanks are at record lows following the big freeze this winter. And they're not going to get to 90% by November 1st deadline.
They're liquid natural gas.
No, I've noticed that in regard to your earlier appearances on the show about Europe's prospects, a German politician, I forget his identity, said recently, we have to be realistic. Wow, it's time to just build up our reserves, whether it's with Russian oil or any other oil.
That was, or at least repeated by the Belgian Prime Minister,
Bart De Wever. Yeah.
He's saying, like, we're so screwed, and he's the first one to say it out loud, yeah. apart from Hungary and Slovakia. He's saying, we're so screwed, and they are, we are, that it's time to drop sanctions and to start re-importing Russian oil and gas. And actually, this is actually a very serious point, because, as I say, if Europe gets to November with only 75% of the gas in the tanks, we're going to have another repeat of the 2022 energy crisis. And I live in Berlin, and we usually pay about $400 a year for electricity. We had a surcharge in 2022 of 1,400 euros on top of our normal bill. You know, this is insane. You know, suddenly they hit us with this bill. We had to pay. And it's going to, I don't know. I mean, the European economy was not in good shape before. But then again, you know, there was just the EU summit in Brussels yesterday. And Katja Kallas, God bless her, the foreign policy chief, was like, no, we need to increase the pressure on Russia. And, of course, we're not going to drop sanctions. And we need to increase them and persuade everybody to stop buying exported oil. Whereas the Americans just issued not only did they issue a 30-day waiver to India to buy as much Russian oil as it wants in order to keep a big consumer to stop pushing prices up. Today they announced they're going to ease the sanctions on Iranian oil. So you're going
to go to war with Iran in order to ease sanctions on Iran.
Yeah. And then so we can increase our imports of their oil and put more money in their pocket, you know, which is insane. But then again, this is exactly what we did with Putin when, you know, we put sanctions on him in 2022, is at the same time we continued to import copious amounts of Russian oil and gas, so that year Russia earned current account surplus of $225 billion, which was not only a new all-time high, it was double the previous all-time high. So Europe paid for the first year of the war, and Trump has now just proposed to pay Iran for his war.
Yeah. Real quickly, Ben, could you give us a quick rundown of where Ukraine's finances are? Because as I understand it,
yes.
You know, we haven't talked specifically, I think, really about where that war is at the moment.
No, that's a very good question.
Yeah, because up until a couple months ago, there was a lot of another wave of real big happy talk from the sort of pro-Ukraine war lobby that this time actually, I know we said this before, but this time Russia really is on the verge of some kind of financial crisis. And there were actually some indicators that were looking, you know, rougher for Russia. But of course, that's done now. But Ukraine is in a really bad spot right now, aren't they?
Yeah, and it's getting played down. So what happened was Ukraine's been running out of money for the last year since Trump took over. America sent zero support. Previously under Biden, it was responsible for 40%. So the burden's fallen entirely on Europe. And Europe has been struggling because the economic situation due to the boomerang effect of sanctions in Europe is really bad. And countries like France is in absolute chaos. That the UK is in chaos, huge debts, massive budget deficits, slowing growth. It's like a horrible situation. Both those two are actually facing or close to asking the IMF for bailout.
Wow.
And within this, suddenly they have to take on $100 billion a year funding Ukraine, because Ukraine is entirely, or at least half the budget, is dependent on external funding. And the solution to this, in December, there was a summit where they went for the so-called reparation loan. Basically, that was the confiscation of $300 billion Russian frozen money. But that was blocked by the Belgian prime minister as illegal. Long story, but it's a nightmare, and basically you can't do it. Mm-hmm. So that was the first line of defense, and that would have cost Europe nothing. So they fell back to the unpopular second line of defense, which was to issue 90 billion euros of a collective European debt that's backed by the EU budget. This basically it's a European T-bill. So this is unusual because, unlike the states, federated states issue at federal level. Europe doesn't do that. There's like no T-bill. This was the second one ever. They did one before, large one, post-COVID. And right. So they proposed a second one. But it works, and you can get that from the market. And anyway, the problem with this 90 billion, which would have been enough to fund Ukraine for another 2 years, is that it's been vetoed by, because it has to be a unanimous decision, by not just Orban in Hungary and Fico in Slovakia. It was also scuppered by Greece and Malta, who were complaining about the 20th sanctions package, which would ban their oil business, carrying Russian oil
right.
as part of the shadow fleet, which nobody wants to talk about in public, but, you know, it's right. there. And so they can't get this 90 billion through, and Ukraine is running out of money fast. So at the summit that's going on right now, the Nordic countries have come up with a proposal to go to the third line of defense, which is to issue bilateral debt, 30 billion. And that's even more unpopular because that falls on the national budgets of at the moment the Nordics are proposing it, which is taxpayers' money. And none of these deals have been put in place. Without that money, then Ukraine runs out of money completely in April and has an economic collapse. So Zelensky's back is up against the wall. Von der Leyen was on the podium today saying that we will do it somehow. But because they can't get the 90 billion through without Hungary's okay, because he's in a huge row. He promised to actually do it when it was agreed in December.
Orban, you
but
mean?
Orban, yeah. And he's changed his mind because in January, the Druzhba pipeline that delivers all of Russian gas to Hungary and Slovakia was hit by drones. There's a row over who did that. You know, one side said it was the Russians, the other side said it was the Ukrainians. Zelensky's been dragging his heels about fixing that pipeline, which is not going to happen for a year, month or two. And Orban's basically saying, no oil, no money. And this could drag on to April. And so Ukraine's position is decaying rapidly. And if they get to April and run out of money, war's over. Basically, Ukraine goes bankrupt.
Yeah.
So everyone's running around. But, I mean, if you just look at the situation compared to what it was a year ago, that there's massive disunity in Europe to the point where the Belgian Prime Minister and Meloni in Italy is suggesting enough's enough. Let's stop this. Let's lift the sanctions. Let's go back to importing cheap Russian oil and gas because they're looking at their own economies.
Right.
And like they're not going to get through this. And then you've got the burden of $100 billion and you're going to take on some very unpleasant debt at a time when you're already up against it economically that's going to come out of your taxpayers' pockets. You know, it's a political nightmare. So Europe is looking absolutely fractured. Divisions are appearing everywhere. You've got new people joining up in the, like, let's end this camp. And it's an absolute mess. And then on top of that, you've got Trump bullying you and asking you to send, like, warships down to the Gulf, which everybody said no to. So, again, there's a huge row brewing with the States because Trump came back and said, right, I'm going to pull out of NATO. So the whole international Western rules-based, value-based order is falling to pieces.
Yeah.
And Xi Jinping and Putin must be looking on just laughing their heads off.
You know, like, what? They're like the Romans in Life of Brian who are watching the different Jewish groups massacring each other. Yeah. And the Romans are like shaking their head. Like,
but eating an apple.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really quite amazing what a absolute shit show this is. And I think as we've
we're living through really historic times. That, you know, I've got a series of pieces in the queue that I haven't been able to get to, called Post Pax Americana. That, you know, the Pax Americana. We had the Pax Britannia, which collapsed in the Second World War, and then we had post-war Pax Americana, which was very prosperous, and it's over. And the enormity of the changes, I mean, I'm not just talking about the East-West clash, the enormity of the changes, the rise of the global markets, the emerging markets, who are taking over. And the irony is that they were, you know, you just look at the technology sector where, like, suddenly China is trumping the West on every technology, one after the other is falling to China. And that the growth, 60% of the world's growth is in emerging markets, and the developed markets, the model has fundamentally changed. It's no longer competitive in a very, very basic way. And Trump has been doing these tariffs in order to re-import manufacturing jobs. But you don't get it. The barn door, the horse is bolted.
Yeah.
That you're no longer competitive. That the technology, the emerging markets have leapt over several stages, and you're left with legacy technology and legacy infrastructure that costs you money, that you can't upgrade easily. And the emerging markets, because they hadn't got that stuff, have gone straight to state of the art. And they're investing in education and R&D in the way that the West isn't. The Draghi report came out in Europe, whatever it was, last year or the year before, saying that Europe is no longer competitive. It had an economy that was twice the size of the States 2 years ago in 1991, and now it's half the size. And I don't know, people haven't woken up. It's the same way they haven't woken up to the new war that they're fighting, how that's changed. So we're in long, slow decline. I recommended to both my boys, go emerging markets. One speaks Spanish, go back to Latin America. The other speaks Japanese, go back to Asia.
That's
a waste of time here.
Yeah, Mandarin would be a good one too. Spanish, definitely good. Yeah, and I have to say, that's one thing you talked about this in the early, some of our early episodes on the economic side of the Ukraine-Russia war, that Russia had really pivoted, kind of anticipating this war and in response to the sanctions after the 2014 kind of semi-wars and taking Crimea. They pivoted in a big way. Or, you know, really worked on building up and reconstituting their relationships with emerging markets countries. Well, really, Africa, Asia,
Global America, South.
Global South in general, And the Global South, a lot of them were very receptive to it because, for one thing, the Europeans and the Americans had been fucking them off for a long time and not taking them seriously, except to browbeat them every once in a while in a UN vote. And they kind of then tried to catch up, but still kind of half-heartedly.
No, I mean, that's another catastrophic for the U.S. Consequence of this Iranian campaign is that process of the Global South coming together and getting organized is going to be accelerated with Nobson. I mean, for me, the telling one was that when we had the, I think it was the Kazan BRICS Summit, and Indonesia turned up, and Indonesia is the big catch. It's the fourth largest populous country in the world. It's a big chunk of like non-China Southeast Asia. So, you know, you want to be in there because for Putin, it's also a balance of China's influence. And they were dithering. They were offered to join the so-called BRICS Plus, the expanded BRICS. And for 2 years, the first year they said maybe, and the second year they were, sit on the fence, see how it goes. They joined in January. And they were like, the way the world's going, like, absolutely, we don't want to be part of the West, and we need to rally together with the BRICS, with the emerging markets. And the difference is, and again, I've got a series of pieces about this, but what's interesting is, like, people have criticized China and Russia for not coming to the aid of first Venezuela and then not coming to the aid of Iran, and they're supposed to be allies. But then that's stupid. old school them and us Cold War thinking, and that we form blocks because we have common values and we're all fighting on the same page. And the new asymmetric diplomacy that comes with these asymmetric wars is that it doesn't work like that. Because EU, and this is where it's been caught out with America, was like, you know, we have common values, liberal ideas. What Trump's done is taken America out of that loop. He doesn't have any liberal ideas. He's just like America first. It's an imperialistic approach. But within the West, you know, Germany, France, UK, we can all like join together in a bloc. And people are blaming China and Russia for not supporting their allies in the same way. But this asymmetric diplomacy is about cooperation on mutual interest and very strict non-interference in the domestic affairs of other countries. We in the West lecture other countries for not having gay marriage, for example. We impose our values on them because we have the arrogance to assume our system is best. In the emerging markets, the Global South, it's like, you can do what you like, kill the Uyghurs, you know, kill the Chechens, off you go. It's your problem. It's your issue. I'm not going to say anything about it. But then when we're fighting against America, who's punishing us with sanctions, then we cooperate. And you had the amazing Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting in November, where you had at the same table Kim Jong-un, Modi, Putin, and Xi Jinping. And none of those countries are friends, natural friends. But they all have common interests. And this asymmetric diplomacy that's emerging, it's not about blocks, them and us. It's about networks. So you've got all these proliferation of networks. You've got the G20. You've got the BRICS Plus. You've got the ASEAN countries. You've got Mercosur. And they're all setting up multiple network. And the thing with the network is it's very hard to breach. If you have them and us, if you have a block, you take it out, you lose. But if you have a network, it's ultimately flexible. And then you can have China and India, which have effectively been at war for decades. But at the same time, they turn up in Shanghai, and when they're coming to talk about getting rid of the dollar for trade and developing a digital currency, which is coming, then they're on the same page, and they're like, no problem. And you've got Modi buying weapons from Russia, but at the same time flying to the White House. Same thing. It's like, you know, you can't tell me not to buy Russian oil. It's in my interest. Why wouldn't I buy Russian oil when they're offering it to me at a $20 discount on $65 oil? You're crazy. Of course I'm going to do that. And Trump is doing old school, you're going to do what I'm saying. And all the global emerging markets are just like, I'm not listening to that. I'm looking at my own interests. And it keys on self-interest. So Russia and China, I suspect strongly, are giving Iran technology, drone technology, because the same situation that Europe and America don't want to see Ukraine lose the war, in exactly the same way China and Russia don't want to see Iran defeated by America, but not to the point, in the same way that the West is not putting troops into Ukraine, not to the point that they're actually going to overtly give Iran mm-hmm. military help.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, seeing people complain that Russia is providing some kind of intelligence aid in China, like, what the hell do you expect? It's weird. I've seen these complaints, and they don't mention that the U.S. has helped Ukraine target missiles, provided missiles, provided intelligence, and helped target missiles hitting Russia.
That story, what they don't mention is that China is overtly and openly giving extremely high quality satellite intelligence. Moreover, China's upgraded its satellites, so they have sub 1 meter resolution intelligence. Mm-hmm. And there's been pictures openly released on the internet showing US fighter jets on bases in UEA, Bahrain, mm-hmm. with Chinese labels saying what they are.
Yep.
Exactly. And that's been given to Iran. So the four THAAD radar stations, which are key for the missile defense, American, were all taken out in the first days of the war by incredibly high precision, very powerful Iranian missiles, which blinds a big chunk of Americans. So the THAADs are basically made useless because their eyes have been taken out. Which was Chinese, but no one's writing about that. They're all speculating that maybe Russia is sharing some intel. Well, we know openly China's doing it. And the drones, this is another interesting story, because in the 12-day war with Iran, that the Israelis have good electronic warfare and managed to spoof a lot of the inbound mm-hmm. drones. But in the last year, the Iranians have changed over to what's it called, Beidou?
Chinese satellite system. The BDS, actually, system, yeah.
Yeah. And that has improved the accuracy, and it's made the electronic defenses of Israel useless. And again, I think you were talking about this before we started, but I'm hearing the same thing, that Israel is absolutely getting pounded. The Iron Dome has been breached. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
And Israeli cities are getting absolutely pounded.
Yeah. It's everything did not go as they expected. Iranian intelligence has been far better than anyone expected. And how could they have known except by maybe, you know, reading a little history or listening to Radio Warner, for that matter. But anyways, Ben, thank you so much for that very grim talk. I mean, we're looking at sort of like I don't know, the global North as Ottoman Empire, and it's a dangerous time. I mean, America in particular in decline. We knew it would be dangerous, and I was talking about how dangerous it'd be. You know, going way back, I didn't know it'd be this dumb, but definitely knew it'd be dangerous, and it's. We're probably gonna have a lot more to talk about.
I'm very worried. Late stage decaying empires, which is where we're at, hence my post and Pax Americana theme, which I hope to get out as soon as it calms down a bit, is typically where you walk into world wars.
Yeah.
And I'm very worried, and I've been very pessimistic in this talk. Mm-hmm. I can see major financial crises coming mm-hmm. in the next few months or this year. And the whole world's been turned on its head. And what distresses me is what you're alluding to. It's just the insane lack of quality mm-hmm. on the leadership on our side. And I'm looking at the quality of the leadership. I mean, not nice. They do harsh stuff. Xi Jinping, Putin, et cetera, et cetera. But they're all very competent. And they're really good at their mm-hmm. jobs. And our lot are idiots.
Yeah.
So that's bad news.
Yeah, and we used to kind of rely on the Europeans to keep us a little more sane. And now you got, you know, Kaja Kallas and von der Leyen as the lead Europeans, and it's so decrepit there too. So it's just a bad time all around.
And the rise of the rights. I mean, the European leaders, I think every single one of the top guys, Macron, Merz, Starmer, are the most unpopular mm-hmm. prime ministers, presidents ever. Mm-hmm. And give the election two years, and we're going to get Farage, Le Pen, and the AfD here in Germany, fascists mm-hmm. coming in.
Yeah.
And, you know,
That's not what we are.
Yeah. And on that happy note.
On that happy note. Yes. Yeah, let's end it. Thank you so much to friend of the show, Ben Aris. And thank you, everyone, Brendan, John, Ben. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. All the best.